Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, October 2nd. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at the weather forecast, this coming from KCRG-TV. Temperatures stay well above normal to start work school week. While thermometers will be a little lower today, the overall look and feel to the weather will be similar to the weekend. We're still in a stagnant weather pattern, with a big area of high pressure in control of the weather in the central and eastern United States. As a result, changes are small, but a somewhat cooler start to the day leads to a technically cooler finish, with highs still pushing into the upper 80s and low 90s for Monday. Dew points have fallen a little bit since the weekend, so what was already only slightly humid conditions should be a little bit better. Tuesday will feature similar conditions again, with highs likely matching their lofty heights of Monday. The most notable change will be a gradual increase in some cloud cover as we go throughout the day, thanks to the approach of a storm system and its associated cold front. The front carries with it a chance for a few showers and storms starting Tuesday night into Wednesday. Due to the progressively moving nature of the front and a lack of stronger forcing and moisture, rainfall amounts with this chance will be fairly light. Things dry out by Wednesday night into Thursday, with temperatures in the 70s for highs on both days. A second cold front passes by later in the week, and it's looking to be a little faster than initially anticipated. This means much cooler air is already here by Friday, with highs in the upper 50s to low 60s, continuing through the weekend. As the cool air moves in, winds could pick up on Friday, likely easing a bit by Saturday and Sunday. Now, let's turn to the sports page. Our first story was written by Ethan Petrick, and it's in the column titled, In the Middle. Dual sport athlete Green stars for UNI volleyball and track and field. And we start out with a picture of Northern Iowa middle blocker Leanna Green as she rises up for a kill during a match against Northern Illinois on September 16th. And she's getting good air and getting ready to really spike that ball over the net. Dateline is Cedar Falls. Leanna Green could not find the answer. Asked to pick between the feeling of setting a new personal best in high jump or the feeling immediately following a thunderous kill, the Waukee prospect pleaded the fifth. Her eyes darted to the ceiling of the media room in the McLeod Center as she laughed at the question. Then, perhaps finding the words in the quiet buzzing of the lights, she provided the diplomatic answer, like any parent asked to pick their favorite child. Quote, they are so different, the two sports, Green said. Track is still very team, but being surrounded by the team after a kill is really fun. Both of them are very exciting and enjoyable when they happen, unquote. The volleyball and track and field programs at Northern Iowa tend to agree as Green competes for both as a dual sport athlete. A tricky balance. Green said she needed to thank her professors and coaches for helping her make her dual sport participation possible. Quote, professors and both coaching staff are really helpful with time management, helping me stay on track with my schoolwork, Green said. Professors are really understanding here, so that has allowed me to be able to do that. I have learned some time management skills along the way, unquote. After a dazzling season on the high jump apron, and a strong start on the volleyball court, UNI head volleyball coach Bobby Peterson and head track and field coach Dave Paulson should be thanking her. During a 2023 track and field season, Green placed fifth in the high jump at the Missouri Valley Conference Outdoor Track and Field Championships in May. 4 months later, she owned a team-high 348 hitting percentage with 95 kills on 198 total attacks, with only 26 errors for the Panthers volleyball team. Her hitting percentage sits at fifth in the conference. Green, however, did not start out as the dual-sport superstar. After redshirting her freshman season of volleyball, Green showed out on the track team, taking seventh in both the MVP indoor and outdoor track and field championships in the spring of 2022. But back on the court, she only appeared in one volleyball match for UNI in the fall of 2022 as first-team All-MVC middle blockers Carly Spies and Inga Rada helped power UNI to a conference title and NCAA tournament appearances, exhausting their eligibility and clearing the way for a new player to emerge for UNI in the process. Sensing the need at middle following the departure of Rado and Spies, Green made a difficult decision. During her first year at UNI, Green spent her spring semester focused solely on track and field, missing out on volleyball program's spring season. In 2023, she chose to compete with the volleyball program during their spring tournament season, forcing her to miss three meets with the track and field program, as well as practice time on the apron. Quote, "My spring did look a little different," Green said. "I did more on-court volleyball. I think going to the tournaments, the spring tournaments, was huge, because I have not been able to play with this group yet. That was very big for me and helped out a lot," unquote. Green's decision to compete with Panthers at their four spring volleyball tournaments paid dividends as she managed to develop chemistry with her new teammates. In particular, Green said the connections she forged with setters Taylor Alden and Sydney Golden during those four tournaments proved crucial in hitting the ground running in 2023. After seeing the court once in 2022, the redshirt sophomore has not missed a match for the Panthers volleyball team in 2023. Green opened the season with 10 kills against Valparaiso on a 500 hitting percentage to establish herself out of the gate. She posted another 10-kill performance in UNI's upset win over LSU at Creighton's Blue Jay Invitational. Then she capped the non-conference season with a 12-kill outing against Northern Illinois. UNI head coach Bobby Peterson said Green's additional time with the volleyball team during the off-season allowed Green to take a step forward in her third year with the program, using her physical tools to turn herself into a go-to option down the middle for the Panthers. Quote, "Leanna is one of the fastest middles we've ever had," Peterson said. "She is going to beat people with speed. If you look at physically, a lot of middles, she is pretty small when it comes to just size, but she has a great jump and she has been able to focus on some things. She has been able to do a lot more training in the off-season with us this last year, which allowed her to connect better with the setters. Quote, "Her speed, while really great, it adds to the challenge of connecting with the setters. So she is very different than any other middle that we have," unquote. Additionally, Peterson noted that Green does have a lot of valuable things, which do not necessarily show up in the box score. Quote, "She is also that kid that I talk about does a lot of things that people do not notice," Peterson said. "She gets touches on things that no other player on our team in the middle will get. She just has a sense about the game, keeps balls alive. She is not going to be a big block, but she is going to get touches on it because she has great volleyball IQ as well." Green cannot pick a favorite between a thunderous kill or a new PR in the high jump. Neither can the Panthers. Despite current situation, Northern Iowa wrestling coach can find positives. Swab's focus remains steely-eyed. This story was written by Jim Nelson. "We're writing about walls today. As of right now, and it has been well documented in a previous column by me, and more recently ignited again on social media, the University of Northern Iowa wrestling program has no walls to surround it on campus. It has no place to practice and train. A lot of negativity surrounds the situation." UNI head wrestling coach Doug Swab refuses to join in. He is disheartened by the silence from UNI administration about the fate of the only home the Panthers have known, the West Gym, that there has been no plan announced for a new training facility for one of the most storied programs on campus. I think the answer is obvious, especially since Swab is rumored to have turned down a head coaching job in the Big Ten in recent years, cementing his loyalty to a program with which he and his family have a long history. His brothers Mike and Mark were both All-American wrestlers at UNI. The West Gym is nearing the end of its life expectancy. Nearly 100 years old, the costs of upgrades to make it structurally sound would run into the millions of dollars, and even that wouldn't guarantee a longer life. That situation grew more dire over the summer when engineers ran tests and discovered the walls facing campus were compromised. That led to the installation of braces to prop them up. That temporary fix did not deliver the results engineers wanted to extend the life of the West Gym and give the university more time to come up with a more permanent solution. I noted last month the Panthers began training at the USA Mat Club on East 19th Street in Cedar Falls. Over the last couple of weeks, the wrestling program has transformed that mat club into what hopefully will be a very temporary training facility for the program. Swab won't dwell on the negative. He and his program jumped into action to come up with a solution. The wrestlers' program has moved its practice mats, wall mats, and various pieces of equipment to the mat club. Quote, "Our focus and the focus of our guys is 100% on the solutions to what we can control, because anything beyond that is a waste of time and energy," Schwab said Thursday. Quote, "That is always easier said than done, but really, we are truly living it. I'm proud of how these guys have done that. They have never shied away from getting their hands dirty. If something needs moved, it has gotten moved," unquote. The wrestling program has offered space on campus in the PECWRC courts 7 and 8, but Schwab admits he didn't give that location much thought, as he didn't believe it would provide the Panthers with what they need to train properly. His team needs a space it can use 24/7. So Sean Kelly, president of Blackhawk Roof Company, stepped in and offered his space. Quote, "Without Sean Kelly giving us his graces and getting behind it, none of this happens," Swab said. "From a training standpoint, with the mat space we have, heck, we have more mat space than we had at the West Gym, which is pretty cool," unquote. Schwab said many other people, too many to name, but including Andrew Stallman, UNI's Facilities and Operations Director, have stepped up and made the transition to the new temporary facility smooth. Quote, "Sunday morning, we had a group of guys from Blackhawk Roof that wanted to come in and help us take down a wall," Schwab said. "A lot of people doing a lot of work for us. Wrestling people find a way, and wrestling people support wrestling people." Quote, "We have now been able to train without a hitch and now focus on what we got, or we need to get this done or that done. It is pretty cool when you have people come together and be part of something," unquote. As far as the spot offered on campus, Schwab said in a video he released on X, otherwise known as Twitter, quote, "We were offered space in the WRC to put mats down in a gym, but that is not home," Schwab said. "Walls are an important part of the puzzle in wrestling. University officials understand," quote, "for better or worse, he's done it all on his own," said Pete Morris, UNI's Director of University Relations. Quote, "At the end of the day, Coach Schwab found a solution that is best for him and our student athletes. They need and deserve a place of their own." Quote, "Wrestling is a unique sport in a lot of respects. Where you can practice and train has more importance than where you compete. So much culture, building of that attitude and mindset. Real wrestling DNA is formed in the wrestling room," unquote. Morris said he gets Swab's mindset. Quote, "He has recruited the type of kids and built the type of program that rolls up their sleeves and go to work where they need to go to work. They are not shy about being a blue-collar program, and that is why Doug's program has been so successful, unquote. Finally, I've learned behind the scenes there will be an announcement on plans for raising funds for a new training facility, one that replicates and expands on what the Panthers have had, coming as soon as next week, but possibly later in October. That has positive vibes to it. Schwab is like a bloodhound on the scent of a raccoon. His sights are set on what can be done to be ready for Kansas City in March. He ignores the negativity on social media. Quote, if that is enough to throw us off the scent, we are not going to make it anyway, Schwab said. Successful people, he or she is a determined individual, a steely-eyed individual, and they don't blink when these moments happen. Quote, if anything, they lock in even more. We will respond to this. Our shoulders have been made stronger by focusing on the solution and not cowering away from it. We are better for it. It has been a bonding moment, unquote. Now we have the high school roundup. Waterloo Swim falls in dual meet. A recap of area high school events on Thursday. Girls swimming. Wahawks drop dual with Hempstead. Waterloo West narrowly fell in a duel against Dubuque Hempstead on Thursday as the Mustangs won 91-89. West earned 7 gold medals during the event. The Wahawks won the 200 medley relay. The team of Irma Mujek, Lucy Parson, Addie Tudor, and Haley Stainbrook clocked a time of 1:55.12. Stainbrook, Mujek, Parson, and Molly Clark earned a win in the 400 freestyle relay with a time of 3:59.80. Parson picked up a pair of individual golds with wins in the 200 IM and the 100 backstroke with times of 2:22.59 and 1:09.57, respectively. Tudor won the 100 butterfly with a time of 1:05.19, and Mujik recorded a time of 1:03.19 to win the 100 backstroke. Fanny Dell won the 1-meter diving competition with a score of 240.95. Now in volleyball, Don Bosco sweeps Riceville. The Don Bosco Dons managed a resounding win over Riceville on Thursday. The Dons swept the Wildcats 25-14, 25-13, and 25-17. Kennedy McGarvey led the Dons with 15 kills on a .467 hitting percentage. Alexis Even added 8 kills, while Hannah Thome and Emily Naughton managed 7 each. Addison Shares dished 34 assists in the win. North Tamer crushes Collins Maxwell. The Red Hawks dispatched the Spartans in 3 sets, 25-11, 25-11, and 25-14. Cruz Ewalt led North Tama with 10 kills. Kylie Calderwood added 8. Izzy Hollett managed 16 assists. Charles City dominates Decorah. The Comets cruise to a 3-set win on Thursday night, defeating the Vikings 25-19, 25-20, and 25-15. Keeley Collins powered Charles City's offense in the win with 14 kills, while Maya Ramrod recorded 10. Sophia Parrott added 34 assists. South Harlan beats AGWSR. The Cougars fell in 3 sets to the Tigers, 25-14, 25-12, and 25-21. Bryla Metzler led with 5 kills, and Trevin Smith managed 15 kills in the loss. Now, cross country, Western Dubuque Invitational. The Waterloo West boys team took 4 with a team score of 111, while Cedar Rapids Kennedy ran away with the win with 17. Ben Ritter and Presley Burns led the way for the Wahawks, placing 11th and 14th. Ritter clocked a time of 17 minutes 46.4, while Burns recorded a 17-minute 57.6. Ryan Harn, Caleb Kirkhove, and Josh Kirkhove rounded out West's Varsity 5, taking 27th, 29th, and 30th overall. In boys' golf, Cedar Falls wins Kennedy Triangular. Cedar Falls topped Cedar Rapids Kennedy and Waterloo West in a boys' golf triangular on Thursday. The Tigers combined for a team score of 151 strokes, while Kennedy posted a 162 and West a 169. Even Schofield and Graham Bremmer led the Tigers and carded scores of 37, placing second overall. Anthony Galvin and Carson Wolf rounded out the Tigers' scorecard with scores of 38 and 39, respectively. Individual results for West were not received by the print deadline. Now we turn to the main story on the front page. Ukrainian students find home and community at University of Northern Iowa. Story was written by Brooklyn Drazy of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. And the story begins with a picture of the 8 Ukrainian students who started their first year at the University of Northern Iowa this fall. Irina Hodin was planning to pack up and head home to Ravine, Ukraine in June. She had recently graduated from Johnston High School after coming to the U.S. in the summer of 2021 in a foreign exchange program, and while she had been accepted to American universities, costs were too high. The 18-year-old had heard a bit about the work of Iowa's public universities was putting in to help other Ukrainian students in her program be able to stay for their higher education, but didn't put too much thought into it. It wasn't until 1 week before she was set to fly out that Hodin learned more details from her friend in the program and decided to stay. Hodin, along with 7 other Ukrainian students, started their freshman year at the University of Northern Iowa this fall. "It was a great choice. I don't regret anything," Hodin said. "I am really thankful for everything, all the opportunities they gave us," unquote. UNI welcomed the students to campus after collaborating with host families and different areas of the university in order to help them stay in the country, find funding sources for school, and make sure they have a community to support them. The students had already been attending their junior year high school in Iowa when Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022. As they weren't able to safely return to their country after the school year ended, their stay was extended until the end of their senior year in May of 2023. They were unsure what would happen after that. It was host families who really got the ball rolling on bringing their Ukrainian students to the UNI campus. UNI Director of University Relations Pete Morris said, "They had been looking for ways to help the students stay in the country for their education, as it was potentially dangerous for them to return home. Once they figured out the legalities, they started reaching out to schools to see if any could accommodate their unique situation." Oksana Grybrovich Hafferman, Chief of Staff and Professor at UNI, was an integral part of the process, Morris said. She worked with the students and families, UNI admissions and enrollment, international admissions, and government agency to ensure all the correct steps were taken in bringing the students to campus. Hafferman said as soon as she learned about the students and started reaching out to others in the university about them, things moved very quickly. A Friday phone call turned into a Saturday Zoom meeting, and soon she was traveling to meet the students in person and communicating with others to see how the students could feel welcomed by the Cedar Falls community as well as campus. Quote, "I am really humbled and really honored to be working at an institution that cares so deeply about the students," Hafferman said. "You could tell everyone who was involved from day one was like, we need to make it happen. Let's talk about how we can make it happen. It was not even a question as to, should we do it?" Unquote. Once that was complete, the collaborators then turned to costs. Quote, "The students understand that nobody is offering them a free ride, and that's simply not how it works with a state institution, Morris said. So that really became the next question of, okay, well, how do we help find ways for them to offset the cost of tuition, room and board, unquote. As they were already living in Iowa and had graduated from high school in the state, they were eligible for in-state tuition. Crowdfunding and scholarships from the UNI Foundation are also helping to cut down the cost of tuition, room and board. Student felt welcomed. From the first campus visit, Luka Shapovalova said she felt welcomed and included by members of the staff and faculty. Hafferman, a native of Ukraine herself, was hosted them for dinner and kept in contact, and staff at the Office of International Engagement have really clicked with Shapovalova. She is majoring in marketing with an emphasis in digital media. Other students have also been great, Shapovalova said, and she's made plenty of friends in her classes and dorm. She and some of the other Ukrainian students live on the same floor and often hang out. Despite the friendly students and helpful faculty and staff, Shapovalova said it has been wonderful to have people from her home close by. Just being able to speak in her native language is a relief, even if she doesn't even need to translate English in her head anymore. Quote, it's just very nice that I always have people that understand me like nobody else can, Shapovalova said. Ulyana Karpluik was already living with her aunt and uncle in Cedar Falls when Hafferman reached out. But she didn't come to the country through a foreign exchange program. She fled Ukraine as the invasion began and finished high school online in 2022 before taking a gap year. Hafferman was friends with her family and asked Karpluik if she wanted to try to start at UNI with the other Ukrainian students. The students speak to their families regularly, but haven't seen them in person since they left home. While Shapovalova said she wants to stay in the U.S. and hopes to bring her family to the U.S., at least to visit, Hodin and Karpluik hope to go home eventually. As an interior design major, Hodin said she wants to use her skills back home to help bring some beauty back to its war-torn cities. Karpluik, a psychology major, hopes to be able to provide others with the therapy she's benefited from, as so many in Ukraine have experienced majorly traumatic events. Quote, with the war, I've experienced some things that I needed help to work through, and I know that I'm obviously not the only one who's like that, Karpluik said. So I'd love to sometime in the future go back home and help people just like I am being helped, unquote. The students themselves have gone through very hard times, Hafferman said, and are still dealing with being unable to see their families while knowing they could be in danger. The community they've found at UNI and each other and with the professor has helped, but having their loved ones be safe is the most important thing to them. Quote, for a few of them, their hometowns are being attacked right now, and it's very painful and it's very hard. And even though they have host families, they're not right here, Hafferman said. I'm really thankful that they feel comfortable enough to come in and just talk or just cry, and I can just be there, unquote. Main Street Waterloo to hold historical haunted tour on October 12th through the 14th. This filed by Maria Cooper. Dateline Waterloo. Downtown Waterloo is filled with historic buildings and possibly ghostly spirits. Main Street Waterloo is hoping to uncover potential hauntings in the corridor through a guided walking tour October 12th through the 14th. Tours on October 12th and 13th are sold out, so Main Street Waterloo is adding two slots from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. and 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. on October 14th. Tickets are $15, and if a preferred tour is sold out, those interested can be added to a wait list. Tours are limited to about 20 people in order to keep the group moving and make sure everyone walking can hear. Main Street Waterloo Executive Director Jessica Rucker said she has wanted to hold a haunted tour before she worked at the organization. Her interest peaked when she visited the Crescent Hotel in Arkansas, which is deemed the, quote, most haunted hotel in America. The tour came to fruition when Rucker hired Riley Bolden as an architectural history and historic preservation specialist intern. Quote, the idea of a haunted tour came up, and so tying in the history of downtown with haunted, spooky tours, we thought it would be a perfect fit, Rucker said. Rucker said with Bolden's research using newspaper archives and the Waterloo Public Library as sources, they learned Waterloo has more history than what most of the community understands. The organization also asked people to reach out to them to provide their personal ghost stories. She didn't want to spoil where the tour will visit or what stories will be told, but said there will be 5 locations visited, mostly along 4th Street. And now, listeners, we'd just like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, October 2nd, on IRIS, I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, this announcement.
If you're anxious about retirement, if you can't stop worrying about your aging parents' health, if you're depressed because you feel like you're losing everyone you love, turn to Your Life Iowa. Anxiety and depression are real illnesses. Let us connect you to someone who can help, because mental health is health. Get the help you need to start feeling better at yourlifeiowa.org. We're a free helpline where you can talk, text, or chat 24/7. Brought to you by Iowa HHS.
Now we turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial comes from the Storm Lake Times Pilot, and it is titled, Trying to Find Iowa's Center, written by the editor, Art Cullen. We gathered last week for the Okoboji Winter's Retreat to talk about writing, but the conversation kept turning to politics, specifically, what the hell happened to Iowa? The retreat on the shores of Miller's Bay at the Iowa Lakeside Lab was organized by Julie Gamick and her husband, Richard Gilbert, and grew to 250 participants in its third year. Gamick, who is a former columnist for the Des Moines Register and talker on WHO Radio. Gilbert was a newspaper publisher and press secretary to Governor Robert Ray. They attract a crowd that leans mature, moderate, and female upper middle class. As it grows, the retreat is getting younger and more diverse. At each of my panel discussions, inevitably turn to Iowa's slide into the ditch. A woman who describes herself as purple from the western Chicago suburbs told her friends she was going to the retreat. Iowa? Why would you ever go to Iowa? They asked. Well, yeah, the place has gone a little crazy, but they still have a reputation for fostering writers, she explained, and you never go away hungry. We got a bad rap going on. People from Spirit Lake were there, where the school board tried to arm the staff with guns. I had the pleasure of meeting a descendant of Ambrose A. Call, who happened to cross Algona with his brother Asa on their westward hoe and decided to stay. A. Call married a Coles and begat a media empire from Des Moines. It's as Iowa as you can get. All of them are avid readers with a keen interest in public affairs. Despite their privilege, if you will, the women in particular were bewildered and frustrated by our state of affairs. They feel they have no voice or are even intimidated in the civic square. They are women with resources and connections. Quote, how do you talk to these people? She asked. Sister, if that ain't the $64,000 question. First, try to fit on their shoes, and you look through your neighbor's glasses. Real manufacturing wages in Iowa, subtracting for inflation, are half what they were 50 years ago. John Deere tractor cabs are made in Mexico. So are toy tractors that used to be made in Dyersville. How do you get from tractors to banning books? It is well proven that the mere mention of sex can distract us from our work. If you can make people believe that sex in school books is a problem, you can make people forget that what we used to make is now made in Mexico, and that Waterloo got the shaft. The questioners are desperately seeking moderation. That's not what they're getting from our politics. Although the group is not necessarily representative of the body politic, it is not healthy to have a bunch of multi-generational Iowans wondering how the cyclone dropped them down at Topeka. You get a sense of things could turn. In Red Warren County, an appointed auditor who posted election denial conspiracies was ousted in a special election. Prominent Iowa Republicans are attempting to keep an arm's length from Donald Trump. The more that likely caucus-goers hear Ron DeSantis snarl, the less they like him. There is at least that. As it turned out, groups organized against arming school staff in Spirit Lake and Cherokee, not exactly liberal bastions. Storm Lake so far has seen no books that need to be banned in its public schools. Local people are moderating at the local level, despite the rot that the State House attempts to impose. There were 577,000 active registered Iowa Republicans on September 1st. There were 467,000 Democrats and 413,000 no-party voters. Get this. There were 721,714 registered but inactive voters, plugged into the system but turned off. The cure would seem to lie with those independent and inactive voters. A system that alienates that many people is not well served by either party. If someone could speak to those people, we could find our center again. It starts with John Deere tractors getting built in Mexico, seems to me, and why Iowa has more deficient bridges than any place in America, or why our surface water is toxic. They want us to argue about underwear and bathrooms. We should be arguing about lower tuition at community colleges and universities. Someone smart will recognize it and seize a ripe moment. From the New York Times, Roger Rosenblatt writes, "What they don't tell you about getting old. I recently turned 83, and while there are many joys to getting older, getting out of taxis is not one of them. What you don't want to do is get your left foot caught under the front right seat before you try to swing your right foot toward the door. Otherwise, you'll topple over while attempting to pay the fare, possibly injuring your ankle and causing the maneuver to go even more slowly. If you make it past the taxi door, there is still the one-foot jump to the street. You're old. You could fall. Happens all the time. And that's when it's just you in the taxi. If some other old person is with you, a friend, a spouse, there's a real possibility of never getting out of the vehicle. You might live out the rest of your days in the back seat, watching Dick Cavett do real estate ads on the loop. Quote, old people getting out of taxis, unquote. I was thinking of making a film with that title, if I knew how to make a film. Figure it would run 4 hours. I asked an actor friend, also old, if he'd star in it. His response, quote, if I can get out of my chair, unquote. It's no joke, old age. It just looks funny. Mel Brooks latched on to this in his 1977 film High Anxiety, with Professor Lolleman, pronounced little old man, a stock character who moves at a turtle's pace, mumbles and whines as he goes, equally irritated and irritating. I used to find the professor a lot funnier than I do now. Slow? Merely to rise to my feet in a restaurant takes so much angling and fulcrum searching, the waitstaff takes bets on whether I will do it at all. Old age isn't what the books promised it would be. Literature is littered with old people from whom the years have brought some combination of wisdom, serenity, authority, and power. King Lear, the ageless priest in Shangri-La, Miss Marple, Mr. Chips, Mrs. Chips, I made that up, Dickens' aged P, crazy Mrs. Danvers. In fiction, old folks are usually impressive and in control. and life something less. I can't think of anyone who has come to me for wisdom, serenity, authority, or power. People do come to sell me life insurance for $9 a month, and medicines such as Prevagen, which is advertised on TV as making one sharper and improving one's memory. Of course, that is beneficial only to those who have more things they wish to remember than to forget. One thing I need to remember is which day for which doctor. 2 years ago, my wife and I moved back to New York City after 24 years of living by the sea. The city is safer, we thought, just in case we might ever need to be near a medical facility. Since our move, not a day has passed without one of us seeing a doctor, arranging to see one, or thinking or talking about seeing one. On one day last week, I had a vascular sonogram in the morning, consulted my ophthalmologist in the afternoon, made an appointment with a retina specialist, spoke to my primary care physician about test results, and put off my dentist. As a result of such activities, my vocabulary has increased. I now can say occlusion and mean it. Has anyone seen my oximeter? Activities such as getting out of a taxi are not only degrading and humiliating, they take so much effort. They simply make you tired. You may reasonably say, quote, why not take the subway? I would, except for the 2 hours needed to get up and down the stairs. Still, it's all a matter of adjustment. It took me 3 or 4 years of taxi rides to finally admit to myself that I'm old. Old. Even the word sounds like a sigh of surrender. I wrote a book called Rules for Aging 25 years ago, when I used to leap in and out of taxis like a deer, if you can picture such a thing. The rules were less about aging than about living generally, one of the first being nobody's thinking about you. In old age, that's true in spades, and that's another of aging's unnerving surprises. You disappear from the culture, or rather, it disappears from you. Young women and men shown on TV as world famous you've never heard of. New idioms leave you baffled. You are Rip Van Winkle without having fallen asleep. To be sure, old age has compensations. Grandchildren, their company is delightful, partly because they think you have something useful to impart, if you could remember to impart it. Waitresses tend to treat you sweetly. Doormen and maintenance crews show respect, and there are positive or harmless activities for the over-the-hill. Women take up watercolors and form book clubs. Men find loud if pointless camaraderie in diners and on village benches all over the country. Hey, old-timer! Well, here in the city, we hail taxis and cringe to see whether the one we have hailed is a normal car for normal people, or one of those sliding, clanging door jobs that require a forklift for entry. I'm not exaggerating much. My point is, whoever expected to spend time wondering if Madison beer is a beverage honoring a founding father? Whoever expected that one's social circle could consist of Marie, who does blood work, and an MRI technician named Lou? Whoever expected that getting out of a taxi would be so momentous an issue that one is a bundle of nerves planning exit strategies halfway through the ride? Whoever expected old age? Notice, our Rosenblatt is a longtime contributor to Time Magazine and PBS NewsHour, and the author of several novels and memoirs, including Cataract Blues, Running the Keyboard. Next from the New York Times, A President on a Picket Line, written by Jamel Bowie. On Tuesday, Joe Biden became the first sitting American president to walk a picket line. Specifically, he joined strikers and spoke briefly outside a General Motors facility in Van Buren Township, Michigan, where hundreds of striking auto workers were demanding their fair share of the profits they produced. Quote, you deserve what you earned, and you've earned a hell of a lot more than you're getting paid now, Biden said, speaking through a bullhorn. Biden was standing alongside Sean Fain, the president of the UAW, who noted there were standing with Local 174, which had been built nearly 90 years earlier by Walter Reuther in the months before the sit-down strikes at General Motors in 1936, a struggle that concluded with a historic victory for the Union. Quote, "The victory over General Motors gave the UAW great organizational momentum in the automobile industry," the historian Irving Bernstein observed in The Turbulent Years, A History of the American Worker, 1933 to 1941. By August 1937, just months after the Union reached an agreement with General Motors, quote, "it had 256 locals and had entered into 400 collective bargaining agreements. The latter were made with every important automobile and parts manufacturer except Ford. And the Union was beginning to make inroads into the farm equipment and aircraft industries. The UAW, in other words, had cleared the way for both the unionization of the domestic automobile industry and the growth of the industrial unionism in general. This is to say that, however modest it was, and however much it was driven by electoral calculations, Biden's appearance was, in words he once used for a different occasion, a big deal. The president, once known as a senator representing Delaware, for his devotion to the interests of banks and credit card companies, announced his allegiance to organized labor in a way that even Franklin Roosevelt declined to do. And his commitment is not just words and symbolic actions. Biden's National Labor Relations Board has been as supportive to unions and workers' rights as any in recent memory. This summer, in fact, the NLRB issued a ruling that effectively revitalizes union organizing by forcing an employer to recognize a union if a majority of employees file authorization cards and the employer engages in an illegal, unfair labor practice, like firing pro-union workers. You can contrast Biden's appearance on the picket line with the former President Donald Trump's Wednesday campaign rally at a non-union auto parts supplier in nearby Macomb County. Whereas Biden spoke directly to the concerns of striking workers and to their identity as workers fighting for their livelihoods, Trump railed against electric cars and tried, as usual, to stoke cultural divisions. Quote, "you can be loyal to American labor, or you can be loyal to the environmental lunatics," Trump said during his speech. Quote, "but you can't really be loyal to both. It's one or the other," unquote. Speaking to unionized workers who weren't there, he also told his audience that, quote, "your current negotiations don't mean as much as you think." Trump has been a boss his entire life, and here he was speaking like a boss. The two events held so closely together were a stark illustration of the difference between an actual politics of class, informed, as it always is, by the particular histories, conditions, and experiences of a particular group of workers, and a narrow politics of blue-collar cultural identity masquerading as a politics of class. Make no mistake, Donald Trump might speak at length about his affection for workers in the abstract, but when it's time to make policy, he is a clear and present enemy of the interests of labor. Here's an editorial written by Jamel Bowie, and it was printed in the New York Times. What if the framers got something critical wrong? Here are three instances in American history, out of many, when the rules of our system preserved a failed or suboptimal status quo against the views and the votes of a majority of Americans and their representatives. In 2021, 232 members of the House of Representatives voted to impeach President Donald Trump for his role in summoning and provoking the mob that attacked and ransacked the United States Capitol on January 6th. Not long after, 57 members of the Senate voted to convict Trump, but because the Constitution demands a two-thirds majority for conviction in an impeachment trial, the considered decision of a substantial majority of Congress, backed by a substantial majority of the public, was thwarted by the veto of a self-interested partisan minority. A couple of generations earlier, in 1971 and 1972, a vast majority of members of Congress, 354 in the House and 84 in the Senate, voted to pass the Equal Rights Amendment and send it to the states. Most Americans, according to surveys at the time, wanted to make the ERA the 27th Amendment to the Constitution. And within 5 years of passage in Washington, legislatures in 35 states, a majority of the nation's legislators, had voted for ratification. But 35 states was three short of the three-fourths needed for the amendment to succeed. By the time the deadline for ratifying the ERA came in 1982, the amendment was essentially dead in the water. Decades before that, in 1922, the Dyer Anti-Lynching Bill passed the House, 230 to 119. It was supported by President Warren G. Harding, a Republican, as well as a large Republican majority in the Senate. But that majority was not large enough to cover a Democratic filibuster spearheaded by Jim Crow lawmakers from the South, and the bill died before it could come to a vote. It would take a century after the death of the Dyer bill for Congress to pass and the President to sign an anti-lynching bill into law. The American political system, with its federalism, bicameralism, and separation of powers, consists of overlapping majoritarian and counter-majoritarian institutions designed to promote stability and continuity at the expense of popular government. Not content to build structural impediments to change, the framers of the Constitution also insisted on supermajority thresholds for a number of key actions: executive and judicial impeachment, ratification of foreign treaties, and the passage and ratification of constitutional amendments. The Constitution also allows for the legislature to make its own rules regarding its conduct, and both chambers of Congress have, at different times in their histories, adapted a de facto supermajority rules for passing any legislation. It is certainly true that supermajority rules promote stability of institutions and the norms that are supposed to govern them. There is a reason, after all, that the U.S. Constitution has been amended only 27 times in 235 years. But Swartzberg asks how we can determine which norms are worth stabilizing, since, for any given political community, different institutional arrangements could ensure security of expectations and make ordinary political life possible. Even the set of rights and their scope could vary. Do we defer to the wisdom of the framers? What if, in our estimation, they got something critical wrong? And even if they didn't, should the dead hand of the past so strongly outweigh the considerations of the present? Do we defer to wisdom and tradition under the assumption that stability is de facto evidence of consent? But here's where we come to the catch-22. Because the stability of our system rests on supermajority rules so strong that they stymie all but the broadest attempts to change the system. And who is to say that stability is a paramount goal? In a dynamic society, which is to say, in a human society, promoting stability with little institutional recourse for reform might ultimately be more disruptive because it creates friction and thus energy that will be released one way or another. If what we want out of a decision to remove a president or pass an amendment is an acclamatory consensus of this sort, then rather than set a supermajority rule which would permit a minority to preserve a status quo that no longer commands the acclamatory support of the group, what we might use instead is a system that privileges serious and long-term deliberation so that the minority on a particular question feels satisfied enough to consent to the view of a simple majority, even if it still disagrees. In a democracy, our political institutions should affirm the fact that we are equal. In the United States, ours do not. The rules of the game here tend to elevate the views and judgments of some citizens over others, to the point that under certain circumstances, small, factional minorities can rule with no regard for the views of the majority in their communities. One might say, even so, that the wisdom of the framers and of past generations holds true. But as Americans struggle against their own counter-majoritarian institutions and super-majoritarian rules to stop the ascendance of a wannabe authoritarian, I am not so sure that wisdom holds true. Now we have the odds and ends column. 2024 Watch. Former President Donald Trump will return to Iowa on Sunday for a rally on Ottumwa, his second visit in as many weeks, as he ramps up campaigning to consolidate support ahead of the January First in the Nation caucuses. Former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley will hold a town hall in Clive on Saturday. Secretary of State Election Security. Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate urged Iowans to turn to trusted sources for information ahead of the November city school elections. His office created a video dispelling election myths, as well as a website where voters can learn the facts of election security. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, October 2nd. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. We want to remind you that you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state of Iowa that we read. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.